thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back. So I'll talk a little bit about whether or not LIGO's black holes could be primordial and what would be the best way to figure out if they are. All right, so I'll talk very, very briefly about some of the existing observational constraints on primordial black holes as dark matter, and then move to this interesting region of about 30 solar mass black holes that got some attention when we first detected GW150914 in terms of, you know, whether or not this could actually be, you know, a signature of detecting primordial black holes. So I'll talk about that connection and some of the problems with that connection. And then we'll take another look at some of the other constraints in microlensing that were originally talked about previously, and I'll discuss a new hypothesis we can test, and you can see what you think. All right, so primordial black holes are a possible candidate for explaining dark matter. They have become, I would say, less popular over the years, maybe not among all crowds, but certainly among some. As just because we've obviously invested a lot into other dark matter candidates, particle candidates, for example, and there's a lot of experimental work being done on that. Carr et al. Summarizes quite nicely the very broad spectrum of constraints on primordial black holes as the fraction of dark matter. So the y-axis here is the fraction of dark matter. So it goes up to 1, goes down to 10 to the minus 7. And then either the x-axis, either down here or up here, depending on whether or not you like grams or solar masses, is the primordial black hole mass. Now, there are so many orders of magnitude, like 30 or something. Yeah, more than 30. There are a lot. But you can see some of the constraints in various places. Now, these are difficult to interpret in many cases. They almost always assume a monochromatic mass function, so you assume that all the dark matter is at one little point, and then this the value here gives you the maximum amount of dark matter that could be contained at that point. Now, it's tempting to say, well, but if I spread it all around, everything will be okay. That's a little unfair because you really have to do a little work to rework the constraints to be able to make that happen. But nevertheless, there are large portions of this that, you know, hover and not that well constrained, right? 0.1, I mean, this is messy astrophysics for the most part, so I don't know. Maybe this isn't such a big deal. Okay, now, so one of the things that got attention recently was this specific window. So we've got kind of a zoom in on this plot. We're at 1 solar mass to 1,000 solar masses, again, F on this axis. Now we're in a linear scale on the y-axis. This gives you some sense of just how different assumptions on models can change the answer. These dashed lines are different constraints that you would get if you slightly changed the models that went into this particular survey. This particular survey looks at this looks at the dynamics of dwarf galaxies. If you had a lot of heavy black holes, there'd be an expectation that what you would observe in this dwarf galaxy would be different. But it's a model-dependent statement. But nevertheless, if you take this model, then all of a sudden there is this nice little window right here where in principle there isn't a constraint. And so this got some press around the time of the LIGO detection, and a group at Johns Hopkins, Bird et al. Proposed, hey, you know what? LIGO just detected 230 solar mass black holes. Isn't that a coincidence? And it was a great question to ask because, let's face it, it is a pretty good coincidence. There's this window, you put the LIGO detection right on it, and man, that looks, I don't know, it looks pretty good, right? Okay, yeah, all right, now.
Of course, I mean, this is older than, so this came after LIGO, this plot?
Yeah.
Yeah, this constraint came after the Bird paper.
Okay.
It was meant to close this gap.
Yeah, but the Eridanus II came after Bird?
Brandt's paper came after. I mean, he would clearly argue that the most constraining curve would be preferred one, but he was very careful to provide different possible constraints.
Yeah, okay, no, that's actually a good point. I had forgotten that was the order things happened in. Nevertheless, my story stands. Okay. Now, this all seems great. There are a couple of minor problems. Problem one. It assumes monochromatic, which, I mean, you know, monochromatic, what does that really mean? But LIGO, of course, is observing a power law, and, you know, we're starting to fill in some gap here, right? You know, we've got masses in sort of this rough range. And the power law is, you know, it is what it is, but it's not monochromatic for sure. And problem two is the Spurd et al. Paper proposed some merger rate calculation based on like present universe dynamic captures that actually the calculation they did gave a very consistent LIGO rate from what we observed. People who had been doing this a long time ago and some newcomers calculated it with different assumptions, and basically the conclusion from many others is that LIGO's rate is actually too low by a couple of orders of magnitude. So what does that mean? If you take LIGO's rate and want to attribute, you know, all of these black holes here to being dark matter, it actually would imply that you're probably only getting at best 10% and maybe less than 1% of the dark matter, because if it was all dark matter, we'd be detecting even more black holes. So that's the claim from these folks. So that's two problems, take them or leave them. So, you know, that's where things are here. Now, what is true about LIGO's observed black holes is that, you know, we have a power law that's pushing to lower mass. Maybe it also pushes to higher mass, we'll see. But it's starting to push to lower mass. We had obviously this Boxing Day event where, you know, at least one of the masses was down to 7 or 8 solar masses. So if you want to believe that they're all dark matter and all coming from the same population, then you have to start thinking about an extended dark matter mass function. At high mass, there are just a lot of different constraints, okay? A lot of different ways of looking at the data. I don't even know the details of all of these. It's just they're so overwhelming. There are so many of them. And also, they're kind of very constraining, right? I mean, this is 10 to the minus 5, you know, whereas most of these other ones down here are sort of hovering much closer to not being constrained at all. So it's interesting to go back and ask, well, what's the deal with the microlensing regime, which is where most of the constraints here are coming from? And I went back and I looked at one of the famous papers in this field, the MACHO survey, Massive Compact Halo Object Survey from 2000. And they say a 100% MACHO halo, so this is all compact objects making up the dark matter halo, is ruled out at the 95% confidence level for all except our most extreme halo model. Okay. And this sort of shut things down, right? Everyone thought, okay, well, this is doomed. We don't have halo compact objects being the dark matter. But people even before the LIGO observation were already going back and looking at this. This isn't something that, you know, people started to think about just because LIGO and they were trying to make some sort of connection. So Hawkins in 2015 has right in his abstract conclusions, limits placed on the MACHO content of the galactic halo for microlensing surveys, blah, 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 are inconsistent and model dependent and do not provide a secure basis for rejecting an all MACHO halo. And basically, some of these more extreme models from before are actually maybe a little closer to the truth than what people thought back in 2000. So it's possible that there's some more room here in the microlensing regime to actually potentially hide some of the dark matter. What's even more interesting is that the MACHO collaboration still has at least one candidate I'm pretty sure that they weren't able to get rid of. And sort of no one was able to say, yeah, there's just no way that is. Everyone's like, I don't know. So it's sort of in this range of like 0.15 to 0.9 solar masses. It's a model-dependent statement, but it's below 1. All right. Okay, so a new hypothesis to test. Here's the ingredients. Enforce that all of dark matter is primordial black holes, and assume that all of LIGO's black holes are dark matter. Believe at least one of the MACHO candidates is real, because why not? So you're basically then relaxing the microlensing constraints, but you know, otherwise we're staying consistent with what we've seen from observations. We know now that LIGO's black holes are well described by a power law, and we are kind of going to want to hold on to the constraints at high masses, which is also consistent with LIGO's observed power law anyway, because there are so many with different systematics that are all very, very constraining there. So we considered a family of power law mass functions, well, actually kind of a flipped Schechter function. The basic idea is you've got, I don't want to erase this nice picture. That's a great idea. Oh no, more. All right. So this is just to give you an idea of what one of these functions look like. Kind of looks like this. It's a power law with some peak. And roughly peak is this M star parameter. And we want this power law on this side to agree. This is like DF, DM. This peak is at M star, and this is M on this axis. This we want to agree with LIGO, because we know we're observing a power law. But then we want to have a natural cutoff, because we can't let it go forever. And the power law cutoff, we can choose to be different places. But if we consider this family of possible curves, with alpha setting the power law according to LIGO, since this is in terms of mass fraction, there's a minus one in this power compared to LIGO's power, not extremely important. M star is where things are going to turn over. If you plot this two-parameter family, alpha and M star, this entire y-axis is the 90% interval of LIGO's observed power law. So we basically say it's somewhere between 2 and 3.6. Our most likely value is at 2.3. These colored bands that curve down are the dwarf galaxy constraints, basically translated into these parameters as seen before. And then this pink band is if you want to put the peak of this thing in the macho detection range, just because maybe you believe that's real. So we picked a couple of test points here. Oh, one other condition, we want this whole thing to integrate to be all of dark matter, where it's an all or nothing kind of model.
So why didn't they think that it's just a star, that macho peak? Because that, I mean, it's a solar mass.
Or... it's a half a solar mass.
Okay, so and a star.
Yeah.
Half a solar mass.
Yeah, yeah, it could be. But it would imply a lot of them, I think, is the issue. I mean, I think that was one of the things with that survey is that, like, if you believed these things as, like, it implied a large fraction of them that is not consistent with the brown dwarf population. Okay. So anyway, you can think of these test points. We didn't do any sort of really rigorous statistical analysis, but you sort of get a sense of where you are in this parameter space. Sort of these two are probably my favorite. And you can plot the cumulative version integrating from the right in terms of mass and dark matter fraction. So when you get to one, you've explained all dark matter, all the curves are normalized to that. And we've got, again, these gray regions are sort of the damming constraints at higher mass. I've also just put three regions here, and let me explain that in a second. But these diamonds correspond to these different curves, so you can kind of see where things go through here. Bottom line, this region 3 is where we're detecting things so far. If you want to sort of explain dark matter and with all these other things in this hypothesis space, all of these things predict that we're going to start to see black holes in the so-called mass gap. And then even more interesting is we would eventually see them below a solar mass. So as many as 1% of LIGO's black hole detections, if we were to look there, would be below a solar mass. And that's something that we'll have accessible by 2020, like if we look. So to do that, though, we have a modeled search for when we look for binaries. If you consider the mass 1, mass 2 parameter space, we're looking between 1 and a bit over 100. Essentially, anything out of this space will not be detected by our present methods. We actually have to target this. Maybe specifically, if we want something that is extremely smoking gun, we look just down here, because we can be really confident that this is less than a solar mass. We have no stellar evolution models that I'm aware of that would predict something down here, so it would sort of hang together as possibly being primordial. So a detection down here would be very interesting. The problem is it's expensive, we'll require... These ones out here?
Yeah.
So you would be able to detect things out. It's a great point. Probably you'd be able to pick something out that's out of here. But it maybe is a little bit harder to distinguish between that and something that is in the bulk for exactly the reasons you said. So if you want something smoking gun where, like, you know, you're writing a paper like, gee, what did we just find? I think this is the region. How many? 3. I'm good. Okay, so, you know, this requires an effort, but it's an interesting hypothesis to test. LIGO is kind of uniquely able to do not a huge mass range, but we either detect dark matter and everyone celebrates, or we put another really good constraint on that plot and really start to, you know, kill this stuff even more.
What about Shadchevskoy mass limit? In all the years of work on equations of state.
Oh, you mean, could we find a neutron star down there?
So we're looking for black holes less than one solar mass.
Yeah, so these would be primordial. They wouldn't be caused from stellar collapse. Yeah. So that's a great question. And another thing, too, is you can't necessarily say that it's not a neutron. We were actually having this debate last night, and we're not sure that we No. But in principle, maybe neutron stars could be stable, certainly a little bit below a solar mass. We'd have to do a little bit more work to rule out other compact objects. But still, no matter what you detect down there, it's going to be a great paper regardless of what it is, because we don't expect anything down there. So, you know, someone will rejoice. It may not be the dark matter people, but someone will be happy. We just have to do that search. I should add one more quick thing. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'm a little confused. So how did you manage to slip all these things in without violating the microlensing?
No, it's violating microlensing.
Oh.
But not just because we wanted to. I mean, like I said, we kind of looked into it, and people were really questioning them. Yeah. People are really questioning it.
The main uncertainty is the halo model.
Yes.
What does extreme model mean?
I am not exactly sure what it should. So I think basically previously people thought that there would be more mass in a certain part of the halo based on rotation curve or whatever, however people measure these things, that have since now been revised quite a bit. There's actually less mass. Yes, exactly. And so, I mean, it's pretty subtle, but it turns out to make a difference between excluding things at 10% or not excluding things at all. And like I said, the fact that Macha still has maybe one or two candidates that people aren't quite sure about, you know, there's some observational stuff here that you can't ignore. It's not just theory. It's, you know, there's weird stuff in the data. Okay, so LIGO. So this is all in some sense really old news. That's the first thing I want to say. There was this had an interesting look at this lately with the Baird et al. Paper. LIGO was doing this all the way back in the early 2000s. The last search we did actually constrained 0.5 systems to within the local group every less than a year or something like that. We can do a factor of 10 better in range, so a factor of 1,000 better in rate today. We just have never looked at it. Looking at some old papers, one of the authors is Thorne, a guy some people may know, would predict that he actually made a prediction like advanced LIGO should see some of these. So we'll see. And that's all. So if LIGO is detecting primordial black holes, then right now we're only probing a fraction of the dark matter, I think is maybe a fair statement. And if you want to explain it all, then you need an extended mass function. It seems to make more sense for so many reasons to go to lower mass, not only because that's the power law we're observing with LIGO, but also because it's where the constraints are not as serious. LIGO can provide some unique constraints or possibly a detection in this region, so we should go ahead and look. And that's all. Thanks.
So we're also entering the discussion session with lots of questions.
I just want to throw out quickly, because this is such a fast evolving field, that some members of the Baird paper put out a paper last month revisiting the implied rates using better modeling, and they predict such high rates if some primordial black holes in the universe that LIGO's constraints are actually about 10 times sharper than you just mentioned. So you might, they say here, 10 to 300 solar mass primordial black holes can be no more than 1% of the dark matter.
Oh.
Now that may not rule out some of the reasons you're looking at, but I don't know if the new models would push down even further than what you're talking about.
It doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't, and I know I didn't make that clear. It doesn't. There's a lot of flexibility here. For some of them it might, but for a large fraction of them it doesn't. The other thing is that I was pretty conservative by saying 10% here. That was an estimate from Carr, actually.
Yeah.
I think from the same paper. Arashenko is even more conservative at like 0.3% or something.
Yeah.
And Sasaki is about 1% or 2%. So all are lower. None of them are inconsistent with this. Actually, there are some other caveats that I could explain, some assumptions that we made and are going from observed rate to primordial black hole mass function that is most certainly too simple, that if you actually correct, I think even favors smaller dark matter fractions. So I think all of this stuff is very consistent with a low amount of dark matter in our current observed black holes. I don't know who was next, sorry.
Two questions. On your general plot with the constraints, there's an even clearer window in the sort of lunar mass range. And I don't expect you're going to do
I was going to say, I can do nothing for that.
But I'm curious, are other people, do you know of other work that's trying to constrain that window?
Well, I think, you know, I don't actually know.
So
you mean down here, right?
Yeah, I mean there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, K is Kepler, right, I think. I assume so, but I am honestly not really an expert in these other observations,
okay.
So can't say
then,
for sure.
I think he's referring also to that region. There are neutron stars.
Yeah.
So that I think is assumes that there is a lot of dark matter in globular clusters, which is not that clear. And we also had a paper, but I think it's very model dependent, the boundary pool. So I will say that those bounds are really very shaky.
Okay, good. Good to know. Yeah, I mean, you can only test what you know or what you can test. And so with LIGO, these things are not practically accessible to us. They'd have to be like super duper close. So in some sense, you know, this is the region. This is the region that we can put constraints on, and so we might as well.
My second question was about why are you assuming that all of dark matter comes from black holes in these models? Why this is something I ask anybody that does any dark matter physics. So why assume a one component model?
Well, I mean, it's certainly not, but if it's like 5% this, 5% that, 5% the other, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that seems messy. I mean, when I say one, I'm saying the majority, and most of these things would hold up to that level of ratio of the majority to one, regardless of whether or not it's literally all. But it's we need some explanation for it, right? So you have to put forward a hypothesis, and this is one.
Back to the plot where you have these curves of different colors.
Yes.
I just want to understand a little better what those curves were.
Yeah. This one, yeah, okay.
So what, just can you explain the purple and yellow curves? Those are all your model with an M star and a different values.
Three choices of it, just to plot cases which may or may not be interesting. I think they're interesting because, so this is the full model space. So in principle, you could choose values in this entire grid and plot curves over here. These diamonds, I know it's a little tricky to see. The purple, the orange, the blue diamonds correspond to the purple, orange, and blue curves here.
Okay, so the purple curve corresponds to what M star?
Here, an M star of one. And alpha of 3.2. And then the orange, which is kind of my favorite, is an M star about 0.1 and an alpha, 2.7. This one's kind of my favorite. It avoids a lot of these constraints, puts a peak in the Macho region, avoids, that's my favorite for no reason. These are the possible things.
So Chad, as you know, one of the reasons why LIGO doesn't search below one solar mass is because the computational cost goes up.
Yes.
Is there a good reason for ignoring the spin effects? You have this 10 to 100 range for the increase in computation cost.
The 100 would include actually letting one of the components spin very large.
Just one of them?
Yeah.
Right.
But you're right.
And what about precession? I mean,
precession is not, it would be much bigger.
Is it well understood how these things are forming binaries and how they're coming together?
I think people have done work on the intrinsic spin of these things, and I think that is something we absolutely need to do to really justify a particular choice of search. I think there's also some extent to which we can only do what we can do. And we all know that, yes, if something is super precessing, super spinning, you're not gonna catch it with a non-spinning search, but on the other hand, you'll catch some of them. And so we have to do all those studies. They're underway. But I agree.
It's 100 times computational cost than we can do.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, so 50 million CPU hours would let us analyze 01, 02, and a good portion of 03. And that's at the rate that Penn State will sell me that time, about 300K. So not cheap, but not impossible.
Actually, how about eccentricity? Because I think that one of the claims was that if they are bromide black holes, it would favor eccentric orbit.
It depends on when they form the binaries, right? And I'm not an expert in all these different models, but the way the Bird et al. Group does this, they form binaries now, basically, through dynamic captures, and then you're totally right, that'd be a big problem. But there are also scenarios where they actually form binaries essentially early on, in which case they would circularize and be these perfect, beautiful, ideal sources. Good question.
You calculate the chart mass with a black hole less than one solar mass.
Yeah, the chart mass will also be less.
It affects the strain calculation significantly.
Oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong way.
The chart mass in the strain calculation.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is...
With a lot of solar mass, the chart mass is significantly different.
Yeah. So our claim is that if you follow our power law down to a point where you can sort of be consistent with some observational things and then also integrate to dark matter, you'll get these really low black holes, fissile mass black holes, but they're still going to be rare in terms of LIGO sources, like 1 out of 100 maybe at best, right? So the fact that we haven't seen them yet, well, first of all, we're not looking. But even if we had looked right now at all the data and didn't see any, that would be totally consistent with all of this. I'll just leave it there. Yeah.
So this power law index alpha that, that LIGO is actually measuring, is there a way to connect that to scenarios for actually forming these bright formula black holes and conditions for that?
I think so. And that's another one of these TBD things. People actually have models for various formation scenarios that predict power laws. And so, we have to intersect all, everyone that works on this, sorry, no offense to those of you who work on this, but everyone who works on this has a model. So, it is true that one of the next steps, if we're going to do this search, is to now go through, do a careful characterization of all the models that apply to this particular hypothesis, and then start writing the tools, software, algorithms, and things to turn our observations into constraints on those models. And so that's something we'll do.
Any further questions from the chat? Any question or comment on the other sessions?
Just a quick comment on this topic. If you think to the mechanism of primordial production of black holes, what Bird et al. Were thinking of is adiabatic perturbations in the primordial universe with a power spectrum which had a spike and had an amplitude of about 0.2. So the radiation density fluctuates about 0.2. So a 5 sigma peak would form black holes. And that would give roughly the right abundance to explain the dark matter. So with Whaley-Penn, we worked out a constraint on that. If you have such large fluctuations in the primordial universe, turns out they turn into shocks in the radiation fluid, and that emits gravitational waves. And the waves would come out at the wavelength to be seen by the pulsar timing array.
Oh.
And so we could rule it out using that.
And
So the fascinating thing is that gravitational waves, of course, are allowing us to probe the early universe before nuclear synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you make these extreme hypotheses that there are big fluctuations in the early universe, we're actually beginning to be able to rule it out. So your scenario where the masses are less than one solar mass would correspond to formation of black holes even earlier in the universe. And then it won't be the pulsar timing array. It may be a shorter wavelength version of it.
Okay.
And we're still thinking about how do you fill in the entire range of scales. So there's a wonderful fact that if you go from light years gravitational waves today, which is the longest scale we can probe, through direct detection, not CMB, but direct detection, you could probe light year wavelengths down to, in principle, centimeter wavelengths. If you ask what times in the universe is that probing, it's just before nuclear synthesis, back to the Planck time. So that whole spectrum of times is now becoming accessible to gravitational wave detectors on this huge range of scales.
Very cool.
And this proposal could be probed further. In fact, if you go shorter wavelength than the pulsar timing array, there's an interesting prospect, which is this breakthrough starshot proposal.
I know.
I don't know if they've even started to think about this, but they will. They're hoping to have spacecraft at light years away from the Earth. And a great use for them would be as gravitational wave detectors.
Well, it was already a simple problem, so we should add something else to it to make it a little harder. That's a great idea. I like it. Well, thank you all again.
Let's